From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Zoe Clark, in for Cynthia Canty. Today, new numbers show Michigan's annual jobless rate is down for the third year in a row. But just how fast is the economy really recovering?
The unemployment rate is continuing to come down, but it's still higher than it was in 2003, 2004, 05, 06, 07.
Then Congress is debating food stamps, and fraud and abuse are words that often come up with the program. But is that fair?
To attack an overall program, which is so vital for so many families because of a very small percentage of abusers, is not really looking at the overall value of the program.
And we'll check in with Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes. Those stories and much more on Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Zoe Clark, sitting in today for Cynthia Canty. On the show, $350 million. That's the amount of money Governor Snyder is proposing for Detroit. He wants to guarantee the city's pension benefits and keep art from the DIA off the auction block. Just don't call it a bailout.
What do you want to call it? What would you describe it as? This is a settlement. This is not a bailout. And I want to be very, very clear about that.
This hour, we'll take a look at where the money will come from, whether the GOP-led legislature will give the go-ahead, and just how it'll be used. And then later in the hour, failure. As Theodore Roosevelt said, it's hard to fail, but it's worse never to have tried to succeed. So maybe that sounds a bit like a bad Hallmark card, but we are going to be talking about failing today, bringing you stories of failure from the Grand Rapids Failure Lab. But first, every month, you'll usually hear something like this on Michigan Radio.
The state's unemployment rate dropped last month to 8.4%.
As Mike Perini just told us, Michigan's unemployment rate dropped to 8.4% last month. That December number brings the state's 2013 average jobless rate to 8.7%. That's down from 8.9% the year before. That means Michigan's annual jobless rate has gone down now for 3 years in a row. But are these numbers a really good indication of how Michigan's overall economy is faring? Let's find out. We're calling Charles Ballard, professor of economics at Michigan State University.
Hello.
Hi, Professor. It's Zoe.
Hey, how are you?
I'm good. So here's the question. Hiring is up, but much of the decline in the unemployment rate is due to people who've actually quit looking for jobs, which means that they're no longer being measured as part of the workforce. So how much weight should we actually be giving these unemployment numbers?
I think we should give them some weight. As you say, it's a complicated picture. This is really very much a good news, bad news situation. We've had growing employment in Michigan. We've added over a quarter of a million jobs in the last 4 years. But that's against the backdrop of losing more than 860,000 jobs in the previous decade. The unemployment rate is continuing to come down, but it's still higher than it was in 2003, 2004, 05, 06, 07. And so it's a very mixed picture. And as you point out, the part of the drop in the unemployment rate is you only get counted as unemployed if you are out of work but actively seeking work.
Right, when you actually combine the rate of people who are unemployed, people who've stopped looking for work, and underemployed, it's 15.3%?
That's right. And that also is down from more like 20, but still, that means that one out of every six or seven workers in Michigan is either out of work and looking for work, or they're out of work and they've given up looking for work, or they want to work full-time and all they can find is part-time employment. So that's not really nearly as good as anybody would like it to be.
It's not where people want it to be, but when you look at the overall trend, is it happening quick enough?
Well, I think most economists would say that this has been a recession that the recovery from this recession has been so-so. It has not been a gangbusters recovery. My metaphor is that it feels like we're puttering along in second gear. Second gear is better than reverse, which is where we were 4 years ago, 5 years ago. But it still is, it's only second gear. It's not growing fast enough in most parts of the country, including Michigan, to really get us back to what we would call full employment.
So here's the $64,000 question for you as an economist. What needs to be done to quicken the pace?
Well, we have to admit, first of all, that some permanent damage has been done. I mean, the recession that we've just gone through is by far the worst recession since the Great Depression. But looking forward, I think we're doing some things that are right. I put a great deal of emphasis on the importance of a highly educated workforce, because the people who have the most difficulty finding jobs are those who are high school dropouts, who don't have the skills to fit into the modern workforce. And I was very pleased that Governor Snyder is pushing for greater early childhood education. That won't bear fruit for many years, but it will bear fruit. And then we've got various training programs that I think are helping some. At the federal level, I would like to see the Federal Reserve reduce the interest rate that it pays to banks who have money in their accounts at the Fed, to try to push that money out to get it loaned to small businesses so that they can create jobs. But it's most of the predictions are, at best, maybe 2014 will be the year in which we shift into third gear. It's probably not going to be a huge, fast recovery even this year and maybe even next.
Is there a magic number for you when you are looking at these unemployment rates? Is there a number for you where you'll say, okay, we've made it, we have recovered? I mean, is that in the fives? Is it, 6.0? What is that number?
Yeah, there's controversy about exactly what number you'd be satisfied with. Well, I'm not sure we should be satisfied with any number.
Right, of course.
But I'd love to see it below six.
Okay.
And at the current rate, it will take some years before we get there. Now, the U.S. as a whole, with some luck, maybe we'll get down around six in the next year or two. But Michigan, as you say, we're still up in the eights. At the current rate of improvement, it would take a long time for us to get down to below six, unfortunately.
Professor, I guess the final question is this the new normal for Michigan?
I don't think we have to accept this as the new normal, but it is clear that it has taken us a very long time to overcome two things. One is the long-term structural reduction in the strength of manufacturing and the auto industry in particular. And the other is the extraordinarily deep recession of 2007 through 2009. Both of those have been a punch in the gut that means that it has taken us years even to get where we are today. And unfortunately, it'll probably take more years to get to where I think most people in Michigan really think our economy ought to be.
Charles Ballard, professor of economics at Michigan State University. Thank you so much, Professor.
You're welcome.
When big foreign companies get taken over, there could be a clash of cultures. Take Volvo, for example. Some reports suggest a few tensions in the boardroom between the Chinese owners of the carmaker and its executives from Sweden, where Volvo was originally from. The Chinese want Volvo cars designed especially for their burgeoning car market. The Swedes, it's reported, are not too sure about that. Stateside is partnering with the BBC, and Russell Padmore sent us this story.
Volvo gets over 25 miles in a gallon of gas, just like the little economy cars.
From its first global success with its Amazon model in the 1960s, car buyers in America and Europe recognize Volvo as a reliable, conservative brand, with safety a key part of its made-in-Sweden design. Car buyers looked elsewhere for sleek, sporty models. For a decade, Volvo was controlled by Ford, until the Blue Oval firm sold the Swedish company to Geely of China in 2010. However, in recent months, a rift has grown in the boardroom between the Swedish and Chinese executives, amid disagreements about which direction to drive the company in the future. Geely wants Volvo to focus on designing luxury cars, sleeker models for the Chinese market, a prospect that alarms the executives from Sweden, who worry about abandoning the firm's traditional conservative image. Paul Eisenstein, the publisher of the DetroitBureau.com, says the Chinese hold the purse strings.
There's a new plant that is set up and is slowly ramping up near Geely's headquarters in the middle of China, and they're looking at building a second Volvo assembly plant over there. I think there are some concerns by the Swedes that it could become too Chinese a company, that perhaps they'll wind up in a situation where essentially the high cost of producing in Sweden might lead the Chinese makers to cut back or even eliminate production in Europe.
The road ahead may be bumpy, but Volvo denies rumors of a rift in the boardroom. However, there's no doubt the Chinese company Geely wants to speed off in a new direction. Volvo is at a crossroads, but perhaps the radical design of its latest concept car, unveiled recently at the Detroit Auto Show, is a signal that the days of boxy cars made in Sweden are now in the rearview mirror.
That was the BBC's Russell Padmore. We always want to hear from you on Stateside. What stories and issues are on your mind? Fill us in. You can tweet us. We're at Stateside Radio. You can find us on Facebook or look for us on the web, michiganradio.org. Just click the link that says Stateside. Still to come, Congress is debating a new farm bill. One part of the bill is SNAP, the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, formerly known as food stamps. Those who want to cut the program often cite fraud, you know, that people are using the money for things they're not supposed to be using it for, drugs, for example. But coming up next, we'll look into the numbers and fact check just how much fraud is actually taking place in the program. And then stories of failure. There's only about a million inspirational quotes about what we can all learn from failing. But instead of hearing all those, we'll turn our ear to the folks at Grand Rapids Failure Lab. It's pretty compelling stuff. This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Zoe Clark, sitting in for Cynthia Canty. Congress is still in the midst of trying to pass a farm bill. One part of the almost $1 trillion measure is the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, also known as SNAP, or even more common by its former name, food stamps. Democrats and Republicans, though, can't agree on how much to spend on the program, and those who want to cut billions of dollars from SNAP often cite fraud and abuse of the program. But my next guest says not so fast. Terry Stengel is the executive director of the Center for Civil Justice. Welcome to Stateside, Terry.
Thank you very much.
So you recently wrote an op-ed in MLive where you note the argument that SNAP has gotten too big and too wasteful because of fraud. But you cite a U.S. Department of Agriculture report that shows that's just not the case.
That's correct. There has certainly been a lot of growth in the program in recent years. But one of the things that folks don't realize is that the number of people who can qualify based on income alone, that's income below 130% of poverty, went up from 57 to 65 million people since 2007. So the program has grown because people's incomes have gone down, causing them to need help with getting food.
And is that simply just because of the Great Recession?
That's the large part of it, yes. And that includes both losing jobs, having more part-time jobs, people moving in and out of work, doubling up with households because they're unemployed, all of that, yes.
So you note that the SNAP accuracy rate in 2012 was 96.5% nationwide. That's a record high. In Michigan, it was 96.45%, some of the lowest actual fraud rates out of any government program.
Yes, that's correct. And it's a myth that the program tends to have a lot of waste and abuse because it, in recent years, has done a great deal to reduce fraud. There are inspector generals that spend a lot of time reviewing the program. The electronic card, it's like a debit card that people use, the kind of spending, what people buy on that card can be tracked. So if people are buying lots of one things and it looks like they're going to try to sell it, that can be identified and tracked and investigated. And there have been a large number of prosecutions and also disqualifications of stores that collaborate in any kind of fraudulent use.
And yet this notion exists. I want to read you one comment from a reader on your column. Someone who goes by the name Red Wing wrote, quote, any lazy, worthless welfare collector / food stamp licker can tell you exactly how to convert food stamps to cash to buy booze and dope. It's easy and they all know it. What do you say to that?
Well, I think that the kind of spending that is done is tracked largely, and they reviewed the fraud rate last time. It was a few years ago, I think, and found that it is still very, very low. And it's true in any program there are going to be a number of bad actors, and this program has done more than most other governmental programs to identify and prosecute and disqualify folks that are caught for doing that. There's a very aggressive method right now for finding anybody that tries through social media or Craigslist to be selling. That's being screened by states, including Michigan, for folks that are doing that to go after them. But to attack an overall program, which is so vital for so many families to provide basic food because of a very small percentage of abusers, is not really looking at the overall value of the program.
And I guess that's my question then. From your point of view, why does this myth remain?
I think there is suspicion when you see a program grow the way that it has without understanding that the program is designed to provide more help in times of need and less help. I think that sometimes when there's less to go around, folks sometimes are looking around to see if somebody's getting something they shouldn't. So, sometimes that results in anger. But when you start looking at the hard numbers and the hard data and what's happening, it is not as widespread as it would appear by the folks that complain about it. And certainly in my responses to the commentators on MLive, I shared the number for fraud reporting, whether it's at a store or online or in a neighborhood, so that if someone is seeing this and upset about it, yes, they should report. Nobody wants to see a program abused.
Carrie, as I mentioned at the beginning, Congress is debating right now the Farm Bill program that SNAP is part of. What are you hearing right now? What kind of cuts do you think we'll likely see?
The main cut that's being considered is something called the Heat and Eat provision, which gives a little higher amount of food stamps to people who receive help from energy assistance. And so that may result in a cut to some households that have gotten a little higher allowance. That's the big one. And that is going to hit certainly many seniors, many people on fixed incomes who have utilities included in their rent. So it is not a wonderful thing. At this point, SNAP households have already had an 11% cut in November. So those benefits have already been cut once, and there is a lot of concern in the wider anti-hunger community about another round of cuts. And so that's the big one that seems to be on the table in the conference committee.
Terry, in your perspective, I mean, this is a huge program in the country. At this point, is it worth taking a look at changing the way the SNAP program works, how we give money for food in the states, or do you think the program is working?
For the size of the program, the administrative costs are really quite low. And I think that there have been an increasing number of safeguards to deal with issues that have come up. And to kind of go back to doing commodities or trying to go to, certainly paper coupons were rife with, had a lot more fraud than the electronic card. So for the overall size of the program and the very low abuse rate, I think it works remarkably well. And there are not many other programs of this size that has the same kind of track record. I think the more safeguards that you put into it, or the more rules and requirements, then the administrative costs go up. And for the percentage of the fraud or abuse, it's just not cost effective. You're paying way too much to root out only a handful of bad apples.
Terry Stengel is the executive director of the Center for Civil Justice. Terry, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
This is Stateside. I'm Zoe Clark, sitting in for Cynthia Canty.
My failure. My failure. My divorce. My failure.
I felt totally bamboozled. Bamboozled.
And I thought, this has to end. I can't do this anymore.
A story from Failure Lab from Andy Soper in Grand Rapids.
So my name's Andy. And my story of failure doesn't happen until I was 23, but it starts when I was 4. And I blame my mother because my mother, you know what? Maybe my story starts in 1968 when my mom found John Lennon, but it's, she's equal parts John Lennon and Jesus, if that makes sense to you. And so I don't know which side my story of failure comes from, but we'll figure that out someday, I'm sure. But when I was a kid, I had this constant message to me from my mom. Andy, every day in every way, things are getting better and better. And she continued that mantra while she was working at a domestic violence shelter. Andy, every day in every way, things are getting better and better. And she believed it. And I was sucker enough to believe it because inside I had this sense that, Mom, I believe you. Every day in every way, things are getting better and better. And yet this sense of, the bottom's about to drop out. And I don't know, I lost my dad when I was a kid, all that, so this isn't a therapy session. Just try to give you some background, but I knew something awful was about to happen all the time, and I've had this push-pull in my life ever since I can remember. And that culminates to 2003, 2004. I got married young. My wife and I, like, you know, good Christians started having babies like that. And I went to graduate school and I got a degree in popular culture, which is a real degree. Unlike my undergrad of communications, which is not. But you know, I got done with that degree and contrary to my thoughts, nobody wanted to hire me to talk about, you know, tattoos and queer studies. It wasn't going that way. So I had made this choice, like so many other men in my family before me, during wartime, we should join the Army. So, and I had this sense of blue-collar background, right? My mom's a baker. My dad's a construction worker. I am not going in as an officer. I'm going to go in as a grunt. I'm going to be a tank mechanic. Mind you, I can't barely put gas in my car, right? So my wife and I had one little girl at that time, Wheezy. She was pregnant with Francis, and I enlist. And, you know, it seemed like the best choice at the time. And I remember getting to Fort Knox, and we're driving down range, and we're going to go to basic training, and the captain is standing in the front of the bus, and everybody's kind of quiet. And he says, boys, this is the calm before the storm. And he had this kind of like Kentucky accent. And we're all supremely quiet because we know what's about to happen because we've all seen Full Metal Jacket. And we're all wondering which one is Private Pyle in the group, right? Someone's not making it out of the bathroom on the last day. He gets off the bus, this angry-looking drill sergeant who was just chiseled granite gets on, and he says in this calm voice that kind of ramped up to when I first heard the word f*** in the Army. And he said, gentlemen, you have 5 seconds to get the f***. And it was on, right? Everybody's running off the bus, and the bags are getting thrown, and it's chaotic, and you're trying to figure out, where am I supposed to be doing jumping jacks or push-ups? And they look the same because everybody's doing something different. And I'm standing there, and for 5 minutes, which it might have been an hour, but it was probably 5 minutes, nobody yelled at me. And I was standing there as this bald, overweight white guy waiting to get screamed at, and it wasn't happening, and I told myself, don't laugh, Soper, keep your mouth shut, do not laugh. And everything was fine, like the extent of physical anything that happened to me while I was there was just kind of grabbing me and saying, move this way or move that way, and everything was cool until we went inside, and all of a sudden everything just changed. And out of nowhere, there's drill sergeants that have video cameras, right? and they're yelling about, boys, you're being sharked in. And I tell you what, anytime shark is used as a verb, you're in trouble. And it turned from just moving us from one place to the other to all of a sudden kids are getting beat up. And when I say kids, we're talking, I mean, 17, 18-year-old kids fresh out of high school, and I felt like I was old at 23. And I'm watching them, and at first it's the kid next to me that gets punched, and he falls down. And the next one gets thrown into a wall locker, and I'm thought, this isn't right. And I knew, my mom had taught me, you speak up when something's not right. And then it started happening to me. I couldn't keep up, right? I was a little out of shape. Look, anybody's out of shape for that. And I started getting kicked. And I remember being told to get something. I turn around to get something in my wall locker. And this drill sergeant kicks it so hard, it goes off the side of my head and it stars and I can't see anything. And I was terrified. And I don't get scared easy. And in the process of that day, we're up and down the stairs, getting stuff from downstairs, coming up. And I get it to the top of the stairs. And this drill sergeant is standing at the top of the stairs. And what you, if you've never been in the Army, there's a secret code and like a password or whatever. And it involves drill sergeant at the beginning and drill sergeant at the end, and you got to know what to say in the middle. And I didn't know it yet. And I get to the top of the stairs, and I couldn't remember what to say, so I tried to slink around him. 63275 does not slink anywhere, right? And he grabbed me and just, right up off my feet, he couldn't have been 5'8", and just threw me down the stairs. And I remember hitting the bottom, and pop, something popped in my back, and I couldn't feel... Like, it hurt like crazy, but I couldn't feel my left leg really well, and I was just freaking out. And this goes on for hours. We're getting beat up. I'm not kidding you when I tell you that kids were getting thrown through things. And we're laying on the ground trying to do push-ups and getting kicked in the ribs, and you can't breathe, and you're crying and trying to hide that. And I was out of my mind terrified. So night comes, and I'm so grateful. They shut the lights off. I'm laying up on the top bunk. It's about 6 feet up in the air, and I'm laying there, and I've never been this scared in my life. And I thought, this has to end. I can't do this anymore. And it wasn't a thought that I should say something and help anybody around me. It was all about me at that point. I got to get out of here. And my leg was killing me. My back hurt. And I thought, I can end this. So I scooted myself to the edge of the bed. And I thought, I'm 6 feet up. If I fall, it'll be over. My back will break. That'll be it. And I'm thinking about my wife, and I'm thinking about my daughters, and I'm so scared. I remember saying, that's it, and I pushed. And I remember reaching up for the ceiling, thinking, not to grab it to stop myself, but to think, if my shoulders are forward, I'll hit my back, and that'll end it. And I land, and pop, there it goes again. And I'm laying on there on the ground, and I can't breathe, and the drill sergeant comes in, and he's kicking me, telling me to get up. I couldn't, so they call the ambulance. They come in, they x-ray me. Yeah, sure enough, it's broken, but not bad enough. Here's your pain pill, son. And this goes on for another week until somebody higher up hears what's happening and says, we're going to take care of this for you. So after about 2 months of me taking pain pills and all of that, I said, yeah, I'm not going to take the pain pills anymore. Look at that. I'm not blaming the Army, right? You can't be... A group of 500,000 people can't be responsible for four, in my opinion. And I decided not to take the pain meds, and it all went downhill. I was out of the Army. I couldn't stand upright anymore. I needed surgery, and well, there are some cracks in your back before you joined the Army. Do you ever play football? No, I played hockey, the real sport. So I'm out of the Army, but I have to fly back and forth to testify against these drill sergeants, and some were going to jail and some were getting kicked out. I was being called a coward and a liar on the stand. And I remember thinking on the stand is the same thing I struggled with for probably 4 or 5 years after that. My failure was not rolling myself off the top bunk. I'm ashamed of that to this day. I feel like a coward that moment. My failure was that I forgot what my mom taught me when I was four. Every day and every way, things are getting better and better. But for that to happen, you have to open your mouth, boy. My failure was not protecting these 16 and 17-year-old kids around me. And I've carried that with me since I left the Army. What do I do? How do I protect? How do I engage to make
everything better. And yet, I'm not going to lie to you, I have this pit of my in my stomach feeling the bottom's about to drop out. And I kind of live with that. And I think every now and again, before you go to sleep, say a little prayer.
Andy Soper telling his story of failure in Grand Rapids. We'll hear more of these stories on Stateside from our partners at Failure Lab. Find out more about Failure Lab and listen to more stories at failure-lab.com. This is Stateside. I'm Zoe Clark, sitting in for Cynthia Canty. Big news out of Lansing yesterday. Governor Snyder has proposed committing up to $350 million of state money to guarantee City of Detroit pension benefits and to keep Detroit Institute of Arts art off the auction block. Now, I say big news, but not altogether surprising. Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes has been writing about this possible cash infusion for weeks now. Hi, Daniel.
Hi, how are you?
So the actual announcement yesterday wasn't necessarily a surprise, but the fact that Snyder has gotten Republican leaders in the legislature to back this, how surprising is that?
Well, I think it's a little surprising. It's been pretty clear to me for some period of time that this was going to happen. And when nine foundations, including the Kresge Foundation in Troy and the Ford Foundation out of New York, came forward with $330 million, essentially a downstroke on this campaign, I think that really got their attention in Lansing. And the governor has kind of gone from, we're not going to be committing state money to this effort, to maybe if we can close a deal here or settle this case, we would do it. And so that's kind of ultimately the rationale that he's using. And so are his Republican leaders in both sides of the legislature.
Right. But it's interesting when you saw him yesterday and you saw these leaders and how they're talking about it, the language that's being used, you know, saying this is not a bailout, that the state is using state money to help Detroit. How are you watching this?
Well, look, I mean, they can say whatever they want to say, and I can understand politically why they're saying it, that it's not a bailout. But as we saw, have seen the last 5 years in the context of the Detroit automakers, people are going to call it whatever they want. And I think you're going to get a lot of pushback from all parts of the state, including in Southeast Michigan, where people who are going to say we shouldn't be rewarding bad behavior. They should, the people of Detroit and the employees and whatnot need to atone for the sins of their leadership. I happen to think that's pretty short-sighted, and I think so does the governor, and so he's putting this forth. It's really important that people understand that this money, this fund, which could be somewhere between $700-$800 million, is not going to make pensioners whole.
Right.
Not if you've got a $3.5 billion liability. This is going to be money that's going to be probably paid over 20 years. It's going to be managed by professionals appointed essentially by the state and or these foundations. It's not going to be handed over lock, stock, and barrel to the pension funds. It will be used to supplement them, and I think that's a really important point. So over time, this money is likely could grow, and I think there's some expectation that a lot of the pensioners could turn out pretty good, depending on their age and how long, at what point they would get into the system. But this is an attempt to close the deal. For a long time, people have acknowledged that this is one of the real sticking points in the bankruptcy, that as long as pensioners are going to be asked to take a fairly substantial hit, they're going to go after the DIA's holdings. And I think a lot of people look to the DIA as something that is critical to the rebuilding of Detroit.
Yeah, so this state money, it's going to come from revenue that Michigan gets every year as part of the late 90s settlement between states and tobacco companies. But the plan still has to be okayed by the legislature. So what's the messaging going to be to those folks who just say, we don't want to do this?
I think the messaging is going to be very simple. And we got a taste of it yesterday. And that is this. This is going to be a lot less expensive to taxpayers if we do this now and pay it over 20 years than if this Detroit bankruptcy gets into a protracted fight. It's going to impact the state's ability to recruit businesses. If in fact they do move ahead and try to sell off the art of the DIA, I think that becomes a slippery slope. That becomes a real problem for the city internationally. not, much less nationally. So it can be a lot worse. And I think that's somewhat of a compelling argument. The other thing I thought was interesting, interesting use of politicking, was both Jace Bolger and Randy Richardville, the leaders, making the point that there are Detroit retirees all over the state.
Yeah.
That they're in their districts. They're in Monroe. They're in Petoskey. They're in the UP. They're in Kalamazoo. They're wherever, you know. And they want to know kind of what's going to happen here. And I think that's also a fair point. You know, this bankruptcy, Detroit is a unit of the state. Detroit is not a sovereign city under U.S. law. There's no such thing as a sovereign city
right.
in the United States. It's an extension of the state. It's a creation of the state of Michigan. And to some extent, there is some responsibility for that here. And what we've seen in the last year, year and a half, is the governor and the legislature exerting and taking on more of that responsibility. That's what the emergency manager law is all about. That's what the consent agreement was all about. And that was what the appointment of or the bankruptcy.
And what an interesting dynamic that is, because it seems like for decades, you know, more liberals and progressives were saying that, you know, Detroit, it is a fuel for what the economy looks like in Michigan as a whole. And then suddenly you see this turnabout. And now the Republicans, the GOP, are pushing that message to those in their caucus.
Well, the other thing that's very interesting about this, Zoe, I think, is when the story of this is written, the big story of this is written, I think you may, depending on how it ends up, you may have a storyline that goes something like this, that a Republican governor saved the Democratic Party in Detroit. Because I think when this is all over, and nobody expects that Detroit's going to be a Republican city, and nobody expects that it's going to be a non-union city.
Sure.
It's just not going to happen.
Sure.
But as a result, I mean, I think the actions taken by Governor Snyder are probably going to end up saving that system. And with Mike Duggan as mayor, I think you're going to see the locus of Democratic power in Michigan is going to shift clearly to the city of Detroit.
And that's what I want to talk about. I mean, how does Duggan play into this, or how does Mark Schauer, likely Democratic candidate for governor, how do they fit into this?
Well, I take those in two pieces.
Okay.
I've seen some of the commentary by Mark Schauer on the bankruptcy, and I have to tell you, I'm slack-jawed at his lack of understanding of bankruptcy. I mean, some of the things that he said suggest to me, as somebody who spent the last year and a half trying to become a student of this, that a guy who's running for governor and in whom this issue is going to be front and center in the campaign doesn't really seem to have much of an understanding of the intricacies of bankruptcy and what works and what doesn't.
Is it that he doesn't understand it, do you think, or do you think it's that he has to put out these messages as a Democrat?
Well, my problem is, and I think this is a real distinction to Mike Duggan, which I get to in a second.
Okay.
But I mean, I think it's one thing to put out messages; it's another thing to put out messages that are essentially grounded in Democratic populist rhetoric,
mm-hmm.
not in the reality of law of bankruptcy law, and more specifically, Chapter 9 municipal bankruptcy. There are certain things that can be done. There are certain things that cannot be done. As far as Mike Duggan is concerned, he's a totally different cat than Schauer in the sense that, you know, he's got the business experience. I think he understands the bankruptcy. I've heard him talk about it before he was inaugurated. He understands the nuances of what can happen and what can't happen. I had some long conversations with Kevin Orr, you know, pursuant to their whole power-sharing agreement. And I think Kevin Orr has really kind of schooled him, and I don't mean that in a negative way. I mean it in a positive way,
yeah.
on what the challenges are and what he has to accomplish. And I think the mayor understands that, you know, Kevin's role here is to get this bankruptcy moving as quickly as possible, and in conjunction with the financials. And what the mayor needs to do is he needs to run the city operationally. And you know, I think for now that's good. At some point, I think things are going to get a little rocky. I think that's bound to happen. But, you know, I think Mike Duggan, if you ask him questions and they start to stray into more bankruptcy kind of things, and he'll just put up his hands and say, you got to talk to Kevin about that.
We're speaking with Daniel Howes, Detroit News business columnist. So, Daniel, we're talking about this state money. We've talked about the money from private donations. But today in your column, you are focusing on what the DIA is going to bring to the table, monetarily speaking.
Well, what people expect them to bring.
Sure.
I think the DIA is very much frustrating a lot of the people we've been talking about. The foundations, I think, are frustrated. I think the governor is frustrated. The DIA basically is saying, you know, we have this plan. We had this plan when we took the millage to the voters of Oakland, Macomb, and Wayne counties a couple of years ago about how we were going to raise our endowment by $300 million over the next 10 years, how we were going to take in this money from the counties. And anything that is proposed that would push them off of that plan, they say, we can't do it. And that's just a non-starter with a lot of these people, because they're faced with a very singular opportunity and challenge in where we are with this bankruptcy. And a lot of things, you know, life throws you curveballs. Mm-hmm. And this is a classic case of that. I mean, we saw this in 2008-09 with the car companies. You know, you had Rick Wagner, then CEO of General Motors, said, you know, we can't go bankrupt. We just can't do it. It can't happen. And as a result, they weren't prepared.
Right.
And
then it happens.
There was a real risk of an uncontrolled bankruptcy. And I think in this context, the DIA can only go so long and say we can't. Because at some point, and I touch on it in today's column, the people who are putting the money up here are going to demand within their conditions, are going to demand some change.
Right.
And I think that could include board seats on the DIA. It could include other kinds of changes in their governance. It could include a lot of pressure to raise certain monies with certain constituencies. I think the corporate foundation community has yet to be tapped here. And when you've got companies like General Motors and Ford Motor Company that are sitting on literally tens of billions of dollars in cash, now, it's not likely to come out of their corporate cash hoard, but they can funnel it through their foundations. I think a lot of people expect that they will be asked for probably low double-digit million figures to pledge either towards the DIA or towards this fund. I mean, that remains to be seen exactly what channel it goes.
Well, so that's what I was going to ask you. I mean, do you think, how does this play out?
Well, I think we're going to see, we still got more fundraising to go.
Yeah.
We got to see where, like I said, the autos come in, where a DTE Energy comes in, where Dan Gilbert probably comes in, people with a real vested interest in what's going on in the redevelopment of downtown Detroit and the city of Detroit. So I think that's going to play out, and I suspect that there's going to be some very frank discussions between U.S. Chief Judge Jerry Rosen, who's the top federal mediator, members of the DIA and some of the foundations and probably the state about what needs to happen here, because I don't think people fully understand or want to understand, is maybe a better way to put it, what the museum is facing. I mean, they really are facing either this deal and trying to come up with a number that they can go to their donors and they can say, this is our contribution. It may not be $100 million, as a lot of people have told me that they think it ought to be. It may be 75, it may be 60. I don't know what that number is going to be. Or they say, we can't do this, and then they become pawns in a bankruptcy and get a lot of pressure from creditors on the judge to essentially start selling the art.
Right.
And if they do that, I think the other thing that's a real wild card here, Zoe, is the fact that the DIA, as we talk now, is still owned by the city.
Right.
And they have a contract with the city. The nonprofit DIA organization has a contract with the city. And in bankruptcy and under an emergency manager law, he can cancel contracts. So essentially they work for Kevin Orr. Now that would be kind of a nuclear option. But, I mean, if you get people that say, you know, we're not going to do this, we can't do this, say, well, guess you can't work for us anymore. We're canceling the contract.
Hmm.
Now, people have talked about that. I don't think anybody wants to go there, and I don't think anybody thinks they'll really get there.
Yeah.
But, you know, there's a lot of that kind of real heavy-handed stuff that's kind of out there in the weeds that could be used if necessary.
So let's just talk sort of short-term here in the next week or two. What are you going to be watching for?
Well, I want to see what kind of movement there's going to be, particularly on the side of the DIA, because I think that they've got a little bit of a window here, because Kevin Orr has delayed his decision on when he's going to file the plan of adjustment, which would kind of lay some of this stuff out. So they've got a little bit of time here. I think that's going to be the key, is what's going on behind the scenes and what kind of pressure is being brought to bear. Obviously, we'll have to keep an eye on what's going on in Lansing.
Right,
the Republican leadership will be trying to work this through their each of their caucuses and to get enough votes to be joined by the Democrats. I don't think there's any question this is going to be bipartisan.
Yeah.
It has to be in an election year.
It will be interesting really to watch Republican leaders, you know, lobbying for money for Detroit.
Yeah, but you know, I think that whole thing has kind of changed.
Yeah.
You know, there is still an awful lot of parochialism out there, and you see Republicans saying, you know, if Detroit's going to get this, I got to get something for my community. And you want to say, well, wait a minute. You know, this is a very singular thing. I don't think people understand fully, Zoe, what's going on in front of their eyes and has been going on in this state for 5 years. I mean, we've had half a century worth of bad habits and traditions that have been overturned in the auto sector in the last few years. And these companies are making enormous amounts of money, most of it from right here at home, not overseas, not in China, not in Europe, not in Latin America. And now it's moved on to the public sector. And they're doing things or trying to do things that people thought never could happen here. You could never get some of these things accomplished. And I think when this is all said and done, it's going to be a very different place. It doesn't mean it's going to be perfect, and it doesn't mean it's going to be the best city in America. But the auto industry in Michigan and the public sector in Detroit are doing some radical things because they don't have a choice. We even had that happen in our newspapers a few years back. We were one of the first major metropolitan newspapers to make some major changes because we didn't have a choice.
Sure, sure.
And I think there are other parts of the country that are not quite as bad, but they're pretty bad, who are probably looking at this and saying, oh, my gosh, you know, they're really tackling some things. And they're doing some smart things because they're having the ability to kind of really look at best practice and say, how are we going to approach this? So I think a lot of things could be very different in a couple of years, depending on how the judge rules and depending on what the legislature does and what some people, frankly, in the private sector do.
And, of course, what happens come November 2014.
Well, obviously, I think that's exactly right. But I would say this. I don't think anybody, you would know better than I do, but I don't think anybody realistically thinks that the Democrats are going to get control of both houses of the legislature. If they did, I mean, you could see movement on things like right to work and stuff like that. But in terms of Detroit and moving forward, I think to some extent we see kind of the direction of that. And the governor is going in a different direction, a very unpredictable, not what you would predict for a Midwestern Republican to do, but I think he's more interested in solving the problems than he is in scoring the political points. If he was trying to be safe politically, he wouldn't go down this road.
As we've talked about before, this is a governor who is owning, politically speaking at least, Detroit.
Yeah, but think about that politically. I mean, that could have potentially national ramifications. I mean, he skirted when he came and talked to the Detroit News editorial board on Friday of the auto show week.
Yeah.
He skirted the question about national ticket, except to say that the other person that has to decide that is somebody called Sue, and she's made it pretty clear how she feels about that. But,
yeah. But
if there's anything that can raise a Michigan governor's stature nationally, it's fixing Detroit.
Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes. Daniel, thanks so much.
Thanks for your time.
That's Stateside for this Thursday. The show was directed today by Mercedes Mejia and engineered by Bob Scon. We had help from Allie Billings, Emily Fox, Renee Gross, Katie Suha, and Claire Tennisketter. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Zoe Clark, sitting in for Cynthia Canty. Thanks so much for listening.